Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
Parshat Vayetze begins at a dramatic moment and ends at a dramatic moment. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, Vayelech Harana. Last week's Parsha ended with Esav expressing his anger towards Yaakov. Yikruvu yimei evel avi v'ahargat Yaakov achi. I can't wait for my father to be dead so that I can kill my brother. And on that basis, Yaakov, of course, has to run. And the Parsha ends on a dramatic moment as Yaakov is poised to, after some 20 years later, poised to confront Esav, which will happen at the beginning of the following week's Parsha. And it could be that these 20 years that are covered by this week's Parsha perhaps can be viewed as the lowest point in Yaakov's life. After all, prior to that, he was the son who was loved by his mother, even if not as much by his father as his brother was, but still, living in a loving, warm family. Afterwards, he came back and settled in Eretz Yisrael, although his problems, of course, weren't over. He's going to have to go into Galut again at the end of his life and suffer before that with Yosef. But arguably, perhaps, these were among the darkest years, if not the darkest years of Yaakov's life. And if we look at the events that occurred to him and the things he needed to struggle with during these 20 years, it's quite disturbing. He arrived in Haran for some reason. It's not clear why from the Pshat. The Midrash fills in some of the details. Somehow he wound up in Haran completely penniless. Right? He had grown up in a wealthy family. And as he said himself later, "Ki b'makli avardi et hayaden hazeh." All I had was the stick in my hand. Midrash talks about how one of Esav's sons accosted him and robbed him. Whatever happened, for some reason, he wound up there without anything. At the mercy of Lavan, who he knew that he was supposed to marry one of Lavan's daughters, but Lavan constantly taking advantage of him, winds up married not only to the woman he wanted to marry, but to a woman that he didn't want to marry, ultimately with four wives. Never asked for four wives, he only wanted one. Maybe some would consider that a bonus, three extra wives, but it wasn't that way for Yaakov. The multiple wives and the multiple children were only a cause of suffering. And later on as well, the tensions between the brothers, which one can only imagine began with the tensions between their mothers, ultimately led to Yosef being sold into Mitzrayim and Yaakov suffering for how many years as a result. And in fact, the ramifications of this go far beyond only Yaakov's suffering. Because the echoes of all of these incidents continue to play out throughout history. The enmity between Yaakov and Esav continues to reverberate to this very day. Our rabbis tell us, Rashi quotes it at the beginning of, I believe at the beginning of next week's Parsha, "Halacha hi biyadua." It's a halacha. It's like an unwritten law of nature almost. That Esav hates Yaakov. And also the internal struggles between the various tribes later on in history. The struggles between Yosef and his brothers played out when centuries later, in the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, the Jewish people split into two nations. One of them, a kingdom ruled from Yerushalayim by a descendant of Yehuda, who was a descendant of Leah. And the others in the northern kingdoms ruled by descendants often, or centered around the tribes of Binyamin and Ephraim, the children of Leah, of Rachel. And the internal tensions among Bnei Yisrael have not ceased. And so these very, very dark and difficult events that happened to Yaakov seem to have very, very powerful reverberations that continue to this very day. Or to borrow a phrase that the Ramban uses multiple times in his commentary to Bereshit, Ma'ase Avot Siman Lebanim, right? And this leads us to question why this had to happen this way. Why was Yaakov forced to go through these terrible events, which not only had an impact on him personally, not only caused him to suffer as an individual, but had real effects and caused real ramifications, real damage that continued to echo not only throughout Yaakov's lifetime and the lifetime of his own children or even his grandchildren, but perhaps to some extent ad hayom hazeh, to this very day. And I'd like to share with you two approaches that I found to this question. Two perhaps diametrically opposed approaches. And then at the end perhaps try to come up with a third. The first approach, though, the one that's perhaps less familiar, it was certainly less familiar to me, and I imagine it'll be less familiar to many people here. I found most clearly articulated by Nechama Leibovitz. Although she makes clear that this is not her own idea, and in fact, I'll be quoting from some sources, earlier commentators who pointed out some evidence in the text that can actually support it. But the fundamental principle that Nechama Leibovitz, the way she views this entire parsha, is that all the things that Yaakov had to suffer with, that we read about in this week's parsha, and to some extent that we'll read also in next week's parsha and in the weeks that follow, were all essentially a punishment for Yaakov. Midah keneged midah. Direct retribution for what he had done. What did he do? We read about it last week. He deceived his father. His father had a clear decision. He made very clear he wanted to give the bracha to Esav. And Yaakov, although of course it wasn't his own idea, his mother, Rivka, is the one who initiated it. That point may be significant. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. But in any case, Yaakov's the one who went ahead and did it. We're all responsible for our actions. He went ahead and sort of illegitimately deceived his father, lied, or if not outright lied, some of the commentators try to soften it, Rashi and others try to show that he didn't actually lie. There's ways to read his words.
Well, he had his mother's permission also.
He had his mother's permission, but does that give him the right to deceive his father? And therefore, she views everything that happened to him as punishment and direct retribution for this. On what basis is she making such a claim? Well, again, it's not really her. It's a number of other earlier commentators that she adopts, whose approach she adopts. But for example, there's a Midrash. This goes all the way back to the Midrash. Midrash Tanchuma on this week's Parsha. We know that what happened. Yaakov made a deal with his future father-in-law, right? Let's even read the Pesuk here for a moment. He comes to the house of... He comes to Haran, and... it's even worth reading them in context here. First, we're told that he comes to the well, and a very dramatic scene in which he meets Rachel. He recognizes who she is. He's very emotional. He loves her at first sight. Mamash, love at first sight, described here in the parasha. He wants to marry her. And his Lavan, his uncle, right? His mother's brother, Lavan. Rachel was his wife, but she was also his cousin. First cousin. Lavan invites him into the house. And it becomes clear pretty soon that Lavan has other ideas. He's not simply being a generous host. It's pretty clear that he immediately forced Yaakov to work to earn his keep. And after one month, I'm reading now from Perek Chavtet, Pasuk Yud Dalet. Vayomer lo Lavan, ach atzmi uvisari ata vayeshev imo chodesh amim. Lavan first says to him, oh, you're family. Of course you're welcome to stay with us. And he stayed for a month. Very generous, right? He takes him into his house and he offers him to stay for a month. In the next pasuk, we find out that Lavan was not quite so generous. Vayomer Lavan leYaakov. A month later, Lavan said to Yaakov, "Achi, achi ata." After all, you know, we're relatives. Va'avadatani chinam? It's not right that you've been working for free all this time here. Right? He hosted him for a month and it turns out he put him to work. And after a month, Lavan said, "You know what? I really should pay you. Apparently your work is so valuable that it's worth paying for." At least that's how Nechama Leibovitz reads it. So what would you like? Hagida li ma maskurtecha. Let's negotiate. What would you like your salary to be? How much do you want? How much or what do you want? Maybe it's not money you want. Maybe you want something else. And in fact, that's what Yaakov wanted. The Torah then inserts a expression, two parenthetical sentences here. Ulilavan shtei banot, shem hagdola Leah, v'shem haktana Rachel. And those words are significant, we'll see in a minute. Let's use the, I guess one could say the older and the younger, but the more literal translation, the bigger and the smaller. Right? That's the way the Torah describes it. Hagdola v'haktana. The gdola, the larger one, was Leah, and the smaller one was Rachel. V'nei Leah rakot, v'rachel hita yifat toar v'yifat ma'or'eh, v'ye'ehav Yaakov et Rachel. Yaakov loved Rachel, and therefore, now, close parentheses, Yaakov then responds to Laban's question, what would you like your salary to be? V'yomer e'evadcha sheva shanim b'rachel bitcha haktana. I'll make you a deal, he says. This is the salary I'd like. I'm willing to work for 7 years, and what's my payment? B'rachel bitcha haktana. To be allowed to marry Rachel. But he describes her with the expression, the smaller daughter, your smaller daughter, bitcha haktana. Again, smaller, obviously, I don't think we're talking here about height or weight or anything like that. We're talking here about her age. But it's significant that it doesn't refer to her here as tsi'ira, but rather as ktana. And Rashi quotes from Chazal. Why was it necessary for him to say that, Rachel bitcha haktana? Lavan knew who Rachel was. He had two daughters. And Rashi points out that Yaakov seems to have suspected that Lavan that he's dealing with here might be somewhat of a shady character. He already understood that Lavan was not someone you could trust, and therefore he made sure to enter into like a good lawyer, a contract which spells out exactly what the terms are without any possibility, one would assume, for Lavan to later on claim later. If he would have just said Rachel, maybe Lavan would have given him some other girl named Rachel. Maybe he changed Leah's name to Rachel and said, oh, I said you can marry Rachel. So he said, Rachel, bitcha, your daughter. And not only that, even if you change the name, that won't work. Bitcha haktana, the younger of the two. Making it very clear exactly what the terms are. 7 years for Rachel bitcha haktana. In later Jewish parlance, this has even become a, I don't know if you ever heard the expression. People say, you know, I pointed out to him, Berachel bitcha ktana. Right? It's become an expression for spelling things out to the exact detail. And the source of that expression is this Rashi. And of course, we know it didn't work. Because after all, anyway, 7 years he worked for this. And they managed even on his wedding night to deceive him. And only the morning after, did he find out that it was Leah? Right? V'hinei baboker, v'hi baboker pasuk chafei v'hinei Leah. So the Midrash Tanchuma on that pasuk says the following: Kol halayla hayta usa atzma kirachel. What does it mean? In the morning she was Leah. She was always Leah. So what does it mean that in the morning she was Leah? It means that all night long she pretended to be Rachel, and only in the morning did Yaakov realize she was Leah. In fact, the Gemara Masechet Megillah also fills in another midrashic angle to this story, and suggesting even that Yaakov took additional precautions and had worked out with Rachel in advance secret codes to make sure he'll say, I don't know, passwords or whatever exactly the codes were, some kind of signals that would make sure, and that Rachel. And the Gemara Megillah actually praises her for this, although one could question maybe why that's so. But that she, realizing that her sister was going to be terribly embarrassed, gave the secret to Leah, told Leah what to do, and therefore, with Rachel's assistance, according to that, Leah succeeded in deceiving Yaakov until the next morning, until the marriage had been consummated, and it was essentially too late. So that's why, v'hinei v'hi baboker v'hinei Leah, only in the morning was she Leah, or was she recognizable as Leah? Until then, all night long, she succeeded in convincing Yaakov. All night long, Yaakov thought he was with Rachel, and only in the morning. But the Midrash Tanchuma then supplies us with a potential conversation that they may have had in the morning. Kevan shamad baboker v'hinehi Leah. When it finally came that Yaakov suddenly realized that he was with Leah, So later, the Torah tells us that he confronted Lavan. But before that, there's someone else for him to confront, and that's Leah herself. He said to her immediately, Amarla, Bata Ramai, Lama Ramitoti. Get very angry, exactly what a bride wants to hear the morning after her wedding, right? You know, he says, you're the daughter of a, how do we translate Ramai? A trickster? There must be a better English word. A dishonest, sneaky person, whatever. We'll use the Hebrew. Bata Ramai, you're the daughter of a Ramai? Lama Rimitoti. Why did you do that to me? And it's the same expression that he used later on to Lavan. In the next pasuk, or actually in that pasuk, Vahiba Bokavini Leah, Vayomer Laman, Elavan Mazota Sitali, Halo Virachel Avarati Imach, Velama Rimitani. Why did you deceive me? But according to Midrash, before he hurled that accusation at Lavan, he asked Leah herself, Lama Rimit Oti. Why did you do that? Amra lo, Ve'ata. Lama Ramita Avicha. She said to him, oh, people, she didn't actually use this expression, but people in glass houses shouldn't be throwing stones. You're going to go ahead and accuse me of acting unethically because I deceived you? Really? But did you not do the same to your father? Did you not disguise yourself as if you were someone else? Kishe amai lecha. It's okay for you to tell your father that you're your brother. It's not okay for me to tell you that I'm my sister. So Nechama Leibovitz, I'll show you another source in a moment, is basing her assertion that all the things that happened to Yaakov were a punishment for Yaakov's actions. First of all, on this Midrash, on Chazal, Midrash Tanchuma, which itself is based on a very interesting hint in the text. Because the language that Yaakov used to angrily accuse Lavan for what he did, Lamarimitani, why did you deceive me? Is the same word that his own father had used to describe what he did to his brother. Ba achicha bim mirma. One's a verb, one's a noun, but it's the same word. Ba achicha bim mirma. Vilakach birchatecha, Yaakov told Esav. Your brother came with trickery, with deception, and took your bracha. And Yaakov, 7 years later, roughly, turned to his father-in-law and said, why did you deceive me? So the Midrash just fills in a sort of imaginary response. Or that, in this case, Leah might have said to him, Lama Rimitani? Why were you deceived? You don't have a right to make that accusation. You know exactly what deception is. And you've done the same yourself. Nechama Leibovitz also quotes a 16th century scholar, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, in a book called Seidala Derech, who makes an even more interesting, makes the same point from what I think is an even more interesting close reading of the text. What's Lavan's response to this accusation? Right? Like any good con artist, that's a good word for it, con artist. Like any good con artist, he has to have a good cover story. He has to look at him with a straight face and say, what are you talking about? Right? He can't just say, ha-ha, I tricked you. So Lavan, some of the commentators point out also that Lavan's name, his name is Lavan. He makes himself look very white and clean, right? Which is the opposite of what it really is. He's a good con artist, Lavan. So he has an answer ready. What, he didn't expect this? He knew exactly what was going to happen. He has an answer right away. He says, listen, you've got to understand something. Vayomer Lavan, lo yayaseh kein bimkomeinu lateta tzi'ira lefnei bechira. That's not the way it's done around here. That we marry off the younger daughter before the elder daughter. No, you can't do that. The elder daughter has to be married first. And that's why, I didn't say you can't marry Rachel, but obviously you have to marry Leah first. You can't just marry the younger daughter. And therefore, Malei Shavua Zot, and you also don't get married the day after your wedding. She deserves a week of what we call Sheva Brachos, right? Shivat Yimei Mishdet. Give her the week to celebrate. And as soon as the week is over, you can marry Rachel. But he sticks in, of course, another clause. V'nidalecha gamet zot, and I'll let you marry Rachel right away, just a week from now. Of course, you're going to have to work another 7 years. Because you're not going to get Leah for free. You were willing to pay 7 years of work for Rachel. And obviously, you can't marry Rachel before Leah. So I had to let you marry Leah. And now I'm going to let you marry Rachel right away, of course. I'm very generous. I'm not going to make you, I'm not crazy. I don't have to wait 14 years. But then you'll owe me another 7 years of work. And of course, Yaakov, as we say, belait brera, without choice, had to agree to that. He worked for him for another 7 years, and then wound up working another 6 years in a different arrangement, which he later said Laban continued to cheat him. Sacha kol, he worked for 20 years and constantly felt that he was being cheated. He said to Laban at the end, "Hichlafta et maskorti aseret monim, 10 times you changed the rules on me." But the author of this sefer that Nechama quotes here, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, notices two somewhat perplexing aspects to the to what Lavan said to Yaakov. Lo yaseh kein bimkomeinu latei tatsira lifnei bechira. First of all, the entire time the terminology has been gdola and ktana. For whatever reason, but that's the terminology. It was introduced to us that way. That Lavan had two daughters, the Shem HaGdola was Leah, and Shem HaKtana Rachel, the larger one, so to speak, was Leah, or maybe if you want to say the older one, but the word is Gdola, and the smaller one, so to speak, Rachel, and that's the terminology that Yaakov used when he made this contract, so to speak. I want to marry Rachel Bitcha HaKtana. So one would have expected Lavan to use the same terminology and to say, listen, we don't give the Gdola, the Ktana, Lefneha Gdola. But for some reason, Lavan changed the terminology and started referring to them by the terms Tzi'ira and Bechira, the younger and the elder. Bechira can also mean the firstborn, right? The younger and the elder, which mean the same thing. But if there's a deliberate change in wording, there must be a meaning to it. That's the first question. And the second question, what do you mean, Lo yaseh kein bimkomeinu? That's not the way we do it here. In the ancient world, it seems that was probably a fairly standard, right? It's a world, not like today, where people make their own decisions. It was a world where fathers married off their children. And daughters got married, girls got married usually very young, even much later in history, by the way. Even in the time of the Gemara, we see it's, the assumption is that when a girl turns 12, she's going to be married. If she's 12 and a half and not married, it seems unusual. That's the way things were. For whatever reasons, cultural reasons, economic reasons, not important for now. And therefore, it's not like these women are going out and making their own decisions. The father's marrying them off, and you marry off the older one before the young one. That was probably a fairly universal practice. And why is Lavan making it sound like, you know, as if to say, listen, you have to understand, you know, over here it might be different. He could have made a much stronger case. Because then, if he just says, that's the way we do it here in Haran, he's opening himself up to Yaakov coming back with a claim. But I didn't know that. You know, where I come from, it's not like that. He could have made a much more powerful claim. Everybody knows, Lo yaseh kein. It's not the way it's done. What were you thinking? Of course, again, Yaakov had made a contract and made it very clear, but if Lavan's using that approach, and that's his technique, he could have used a much more powerful technique and just said, Lo yaseh kein. Why Lo yaseh kein bimkomeinu? And therefore, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, that Nechama quotes, suggests that these two questions reveal textual hints that the Torah is putting in here to show us what Lavan was really saying to Yaakov. Lo yaseh kein bimkomeinu, ulai bimkomchem yaseh dvarim keile. Maybe where you come from, things like this are done. Ach lo yaseh kein bimkomeinu latei tatsi'ira lifnei habichira. And the word tsi'ira and bichira echo the concept of bichora. What had Yaakov done to Esav? He had bought from Esav the bichora, the birthright, right? And he And he was the tzair. He was the younger one. Right? And Rivka, at the beginning of last week's parsha, if you remember, when Rivka was pregnant with the she didn't even know she was pregnant with. When Rivka was pregnant, she had this unusual pregnancy. She felt this literally turmoil inside of her body and didn't understand it. She went to a Navi and received a nivuah. That is, Shnei Goyim Bevitnech. You're not just, first of all, you're carrying twins, but not just two children. You're carrying actually two nations in your womb. This is like a meta-historic prophecy, what you got here, right? That the struggle that you're experiencing, the physical discomfort you're experiencing, is a reflection of something much deeper. The eternal struggle between these two nations that are currently in your womb. Ushnei le'umim mine'ayich yiparedu, u'le'om mile'om ye'emats, and these two nations will constantly be in struggle with one another. Virav ya'avod tsa'ir. And the rav, which means the greater one, a word similar to gadol perhaps, will ultimately serve the younger. So Yaakov is called the tsa'ir. The word tsa'ir, young. And he took from Esav the bichora. And Lavan, therefore, so basically, what he's showing here is that this pasuk can be read also, if you're very sensitive to language, as a sharp rebuke of Yaakov. A psychological attack on Yaakov. You're coming to me. Now let's put the two together. You're coming to me with indignation and saying, Lama rimi tani? Why did you deceive me? You're a hypocrite. Lo ye asekein bim komein. That's not the way we do things over here. Maybe where you come from, it's okay to act bin mirma. And then to turn around and accuse me of mirma. But where I come from, we don't place the tsa'ir before the bechor. But you who just used mirma, you are the tsa'ir, and managed to take what belongs to the bechor, don't think you can come ahead and get the tsa'ira lefnei habechira. And therefore, the way this whole approach reads the text, Yaakov was being told, and Nechama Leibovitz then develops the fact that probably Lavan himself didn't know all the background. Lavan was just being Lavan. He's just a con artist. But God put these words into his mouth. Yaakov undoubtedly understood that when the words were ringing in his ears, he kept calling her Hagedola, Haktana. And he's hearing, no, she's the Tzi'ira. And the Tzi'ira doesn't come before the Bechira. And what do you mean, Lama Rimitani, and Lo Ye Asakein Bim Komeinu? As if Yaakov himself must have suddenly realized that he brought this upon himself. Now this approach, if one develops it further, leads to some very, very dramatic and perhaps quite disturbing implications. First of all, it means, therefore, that Yaakov brought this all upon himself. And again, as we said at the outset, it's not just that he brought it upon himself, it means he brought it upon all of us, for all of history. Because this wasn't just, it wasn't that he personally suffered, you know, by having to deal with this issue for 7 years, for 14 years, for 20 years, for the rest of his life even. But the ramifications of this, that he wound up married to these two women, ultimately four women, and the struggles with his own brother, and the struggles among his own children, those things continue to reverberate. And it leads to one to question, well, if he's punished for this, then assumedly it means he shouldn't have done it. That's a fair assumption, right? So if we take this whole approach, let's go back and rewind now. Let's go back to last week's parsha and rewind and say, well, what should Yaakov have done? His mother hears that his father, Yitzchak, told Esav, go get me, catch me an animal, make me food, and you're going to get the bracha. And Rivka decides that she has to do something dramatic and devises this plan and tells Yaakov, this is what you're going to do. If we're going to assume that Yaakov was later punished for all of that, it means he should have refused. He should have said to his mother, no. And Eileen points out, well, you know, you're not supposed to say no to your mother, but on the other hand, his mother's telling him to deceive his father. So he has to, it's not just a matter of kibud avayim here. He's got to choose between the two, and he should have done what's right. Again, according to this approach, he should have said to his mother, I'm sorry, I refuse. What other options are there? Either try to go talk to Yitzchak directly. Knock on the door. Hi, I'm Yaakov. Can I talk to you? Do you know that I know I'm younger than my brother, but do you know that I bought the Bechorah from him? Maybe Rivka should have gone and told Yitzchak about the prophecy that she heard, which it seems Yitzchak was never told. Right? God himself said, Rav Yavot Zahir, put it on the table. Don't act with trickery. Be yashar. Be upright. Take the high road.
Was Yaakov totally blind?
Yitzchak.
Yitzchak totally blind? Or was he able to see?
Listen, it says, Vatichena einav mirot. But at least on the level of pshat, Yaakov managed to deceive him by simply, if he was able to see that, you know, obviously.
But he was feeling.
So he felt it because he couldn't see. Right? The goat skin on his arm wouldn't really.
Was it ever written? In other words,
it says Vatichena einav mirot, which seems to mean like his eyes were dimmed. Maybe he could see a little bit. Uh-huh. The only discussions I've seen about it are discussions that suggest that there's something deeper to the expression Vatichena einav mirot. There wasn't just a physical blindness or lack of sight, but he was blinded to what was going on around him in a much deeper sense. I think we talked about that a little bit last week.
The image of the angel's
tears, which obviously is a metaphoric image. What does that image mean? In other words, it means that Yitzchak's blindness was something much deeper than just a physical ailment. It meant that he was sort of disconnected and not really aware of what was going on around him on a certain level, right? In any case, if we go with this approach, well, we have to then ask, well, what would have then happened? Assumedly, if God already promised that bracha is going to go to Yaakov, so somehow it would have worked out without Yaakov being blamable. Yitzchak himself would have had to understand. And then, first of all, assumedly Esav would still be disappointed. But perhaps it would have been done in such a way in which he couldn't blame Yaakov. He certainly wouldn't be able to say, you know, it's all his fault. What did he say about Yaakov? And this is important also. He said, Hachi kara shemo Yaakov, vaya'akveni ze pa'amayim. The word Yaakov, which came from the fact that Yaakov was born holding on to Esav's heel, itself very symbolic, Akev being heel, also can mean la'akov, to uproot or to prevent. Right? In halachic terminology, the term me'akev, right, means if you're, I guess in modern Hebrew also, if you're me'akev something, it means you're preventing something. And Esav was able to say about it, and that's why he's called Yaakov. Vaya'akveni, look what he did to me. If this had been done on the up and up, Yitzchak might have had to call Esav back and say, look, I'm sorry, but I've changed my mind, or it's become clear to me that you don't deserve the bracha. And perhaps Esav's anger would have been directed against his father, less against Yaakov. At the very least, he wouldn't have had the ammunition to say, look what Yaakov did to me. And if it's true that all that happened afterwards was a punishment for this, then assumedly he wouldn't have had to suffer that punishment. He would have married Rachel. Perhaps only Rachel. And all of his 12 children would be born from one wife. And all of that suffering that came as a result wouldn't have happened. The enmity with Esav might have been eliminated or at least reduced. The disharmony between his children would have been perhaps normal sibling rivalry, but at least they would have had the same mother. And all of history might have been different. So this is one approach. Very, very, to me, at least. Not one that I was brought up thinking. One that I first became associated with through the two articles in Nechum Leibovitz's Sefer. But one which is based on earlier commentaries and which I think it's now clear has at least a strong case to make from certain hints in the text. So that's one approach. One that sort of blames Yaakov for everything that happened. Yaakov's mistake, or moral failing if you want. And then we're still trying to put together the pieces. However, there are some other voices, even Nechama quotes a little bit in these articles, and I read a few other articles, which point out that there are some problems with her approach also, textual problems. with her approach. First of all, it's important to point out that although indeed Yaakov used deception to get the bracha from Yitzchak, he was clearly right to do. Meaning, he had a right to the bracha. First of all, he had bought it. If we assume that the bracha and the bechorah are connected, and that's a question in its own right, could be the topic of a different shiur. But let's assume that the two are connected. So he had bought it from Esav, made a deal. And Esav, in full, you know, maybe you could argue, you know, this bracha and bechorah, which seem to have eternal consequences, you know, for a pot of soup, it sounds like Yaakov kind of got a good deal there. It seems like Esav was cheated by paying such a small price for such an eternally valuable thing. But on the other hand, Esav made clear that he was willing to pay the price because it was worth nothing to him. The Torah also testifies afterwards, Esav despised the Bechorah. So he bought it. And besides that, and perhaps even more important than that, it had been preordained before they were born. Rivka was told a prophecy. V'rav Ya'avod Tzair. So Yaakov had the right to the bracha, and what Yitzchak was about to do was wrong. He didn't understand he was about to do something wrong. But it's hard to say that this was a chid. Now that, of course, opens up a very interesting moral question. A difficult moral question. To what extent do the ends justify the means? And although it's easy to say, the ends never justify the means. You know, just because you're going to accomplish something proper doesn't mean that you can use improper means to get it. But in real life, it's never quite that simple. It's true in the extreme, but life is such that sometimes it's not so clear. But in addition to that fact, there are additional arguments that can be made to suggest that Yaakov did not do something wrong. And in addition to the fact that he deserved the bracha and it was rightfully his, even the act of deception seems to have, one can bring some significant support for the idea that it wasn't really something wrong. First of all, here, this is Nechama Leibovitz herself quotes as well. It seems that at the very least, Yaakov himself was not very eager to do this. His mother told him to, and he seemed to feel that he has to listen to her, but he didn't really want to. She quotes here from the Sefer HaKetav VaKabbalah, who also notices something interesting in the language that Yaakov had used. He said to his mother back in last week's Parsha, you know, what was his objection? She said, this is what you're going to do. I'm going to cook food for you, and you're going to go and present that to your father and tell him that you're Esav, you can't see, and it's going to work. So on the one hand, Yaakov's objection that he raises is not a moral one. He didn't say to his mother, you know, look, that's wrong. I refuse to cooperate in such a thing. I'm not going to lie. Instead, he used what might be seen as just expressed reservations simply about whether it would actually work. He said to her, look, you have to understand, as you know, my father can't see, but he can feel, and I'm very different than Esav, even just feeling our skin. Esav is very hairy. Esav achi ish sa'ir, vanochi ish chalak. Esav is very hairy and I'm smooth. Ulay yimusheni avi. Maybe my father will feel me, because he can't see, and that's how he'll know. And so Rivka has an answer that, you know, I'm going to give you a disguise. A disguise which doesn't work if you can see, but a disguise that works very well for someone who can only feel. So the Sefer Ketav Kabbalah notices that word ulay yimusheni avi, ulay, which means maybe, is a little strange. He points out that usually when a person in Hebrew, when a person wants to discuss something that may happen in the future, something that he doesn't want to happen, the Hebrew word for that is usually pen, not ulai. And he gives examples here. Like, for example, all the way in the beginning of Sefer Bereishit in Gan Eden, God said after Adam and Chava sinned and they needed to be kicked out of Gan Eden, they ate from the Eitz Hadaat, and they said, God said, if I let them stay in Gan Eden, maybe they'll take from the Eitz HaChayim also. And that's not saying one, so I have to. So the expression is, pen yishlach yado v'ikach gam Eitz HaChayim. Or later on, it says that when Yaakov later had to send the brothers down to Mitzrayim to try to retrieve Shimon, he didn't want to let them. He didn't want to send them with Binyamin, right? He didn't want to send Binyamin. He sent the other brothers, but not Binyamin, because pen yikra'inu ason, lest, it's usually translated in English, lest this happen. So when you're talking about something that you don't want to happen, I'm worried that this might happen. You usually use the word pen, lest this happen. So we would have expected Yaakov to say to his mother, I can't do this because pen yimusheni avi. But instead he used the word ulai. And ulai, the Kabbalah points out, is usually used to express a potential future event that a person is hoping will happen. For example, in next week's parsha, when Yaakov is about to meet Esav and he sends gifts to Esav in advance to try to sort of placate Esav, and he says, ulai yisapanai, maybe I will get him to,
He's more like Efshar.
Well, so the Ketav Kabbalah suggests that when Yaakov said to his mother, ulai yimusheni avi, he's sort of psychologically saying, I hope. He's expressing the fact that he's hoping he's going to be discovered. Just one second. Because he doesn't, he's reading into that word ulai, sort of an indication that Yaakov was very uncomfortable with what he was about to do. And he was sort of expressing to his mother, look, it's not going to work. I hope it's not going to work. Right? Instead of saying, lest this happen, he's almost saying a word that implies, I hope it happened. I hope I'll be discovered if I do this.
So
just one second. And also, what?
Right. It's not the same. When he sent the gifts, he was hoping perhaps it would placate Esau. So it's not.
No. So he's suggesting that Yaakov was again, perhaps subconsciously indicating that he's hoping he'll be discovered. Mm-hmm. If I'm forced to do this, I'm going to go in there, and I hope Yitzchak figures it out, so that in the end I won't deceive him, I won't be guilty, mm-hmm. And he'll catch. I hope I get caught before I'm able to pull it off. And furthermore, she points out also the Ketav Kabbalah also points out that after that, the expression used is, it says, okay, she told him, go get me the animal, and I'll do this. And he had this argument with her, and she said, don't worry, I worked it out. It says, Vayelech Vayavov, he went and he took it. It says, Vayelech, he went to get the animal. It doesn't use, and he brings here a whole long list of other examples expressing, for example, when Avraham went to get the animal to serve the three angels, it says vayimaher, vayarots, right? It shows eagerness. And there was an urgency here. Esav's coming back any minute. I mean, in the end, Yaakov managed to get the bracha. It's like, the way the text describes it, it's like Yaakov walked out one door and Esav walked in the next door and said, I'm here, right? They didn't have time to spare. And the Torah doesn't say that Yaakov ran. Again, she reads this as, it looks like Yaakov was hoping that the plan would fail. And he, in the end, did it. Perhaps God ordained that it not fail. So that's another indication that perhaps, at the very least, Yaakov was torn about it. It wasn't something that he was eager to do. But perhaps the most powerful argument that Yaakov is not to blame for deceiving Yitzchak is that retroactively, what Yaakov did was endorsed by no one else other than Yitzchak himself. What happened? First of all, Yitzchak, for all of the blindness, and whether it's only physical blindness or beyond that, for all of the, Yitzchak showed himself to not be such an old man, who foolish, senile old man who you can completely manipulate. Turns out that Yitzchak was at least alert enough to be suspicious. You know, he comes in, Yaakov, and he says to his father, Abba, right? He says, Vayavo el Aviv, I'm reading from Perek Chav Zayin, Pasuk Yud Chet, last week's parasha. Vayavo el Aviv, he comes to his father, Vayomer Avi. Hi, Dad. Now, Yitzchak has sent Esav out, and Yitzchak is expecting Esav to come back. One would expect him to say, hi, Esav, right? Instead, Yitzchak's immediate response is, Mi ata bini, who are you? So Yaakov says, Anochi Esav b'chorecha, asiti kasher dibarta elai, kumna shva b'achlam yitzedi b'avor tvarchani nafshecha. I'm Esav, your son, and I did what you said, and now it's time to bless me. Okay, one would expect Yitzchak to say, oh, okay, come. Mazemi har tell him so, bini, how'd you come so quickly? And Yaakov gives him an answer for that. And then he says, come here, I want to feel you. I'm suspicious. Right? Exactly what Yaakov thought he was going to do. But not just he happened to, I want to give you a hug, my son. No, he called him over. It's clear that Yitzchak is suspicious. Come here, I want to feel you. So Yaakov goes, because of the disguise, Yitzchak feels him. And he says, this is strange, famous words. Hakol kol Yaakov v'hayadayim yidei Esav. And then he decides to give him the bracha. At the very, very least, Yitzchak was quite suspicious at that moment. The Netziv suggests that at that moment, Yitzchak realized exactly what was going on.
Right.
When he said, Hakol kol Yaakov v'hayadayim yidei Esav, what he was actually saying, according to the Netziv, is I understand exactly what's going on here. And I now realize that you deserve the bracha. See, this is a shiur we could have given last week, so I won't go into it. But you know, one could question what Yitzchak's intentions were. It seems, at least according to the way many read the text, that it wasn't that Yitzchak intended to give the bracha to Esav instead of to Yaakov, but rather that he intended to bless both of them. Because Yitzchak ultimately gives Yaakov two blessings. One that was originally intended for Esav, but then he gives him another one. And to just summarize it in one sentence, at least many of the commentators suggest that Yitzchak didn't realize that he had to choose between the sons, and he wanted to divide up responsibilities. And he wanted to give Esav a blessing that was basically about material success, and Yaakov was going to get the spiritual bracha, and he thought that was appropriate. Esav is the ish tzayeh, the ish sadeh, Yaakov is the ish tam yoshev o'alim. When he said to him now, when he sees, he viewed Yaakov perhaps as this timid, you know, spiritual kind of guy, not someone who could be the political leader, the military leader. And therefore, he figured, okay, I'm going to make Esav into the king, into the prime minister, into the whatever, and Yaakov's going to be the Kohen, the rabbi, the scholar, and that's how they're going to divide it up. Now he said to him, I see, this is the way the Netziv said, I see that not only do you have the kol of Yaakov, that you also know how to use the adayim of Esav. And therefore you deserve both blessings. And read that way, Yitzchak, first of all, wasn't deceived in the end. What Yitzchak did, the Malbim also reads it this way, that what Yaakov did ultimately was not so much a deception as a demonstration to his father, look, Abba, I can do this too. And according to this reading, Yitzchak understood it. He said, you have the kol of Yaakov and the Adayim of Esav, I'm going to willfully give you the bracha. Even if one doesn't accept that reading, even if one thinks that Yitzchak, although he was clearly suspicious, in the end was convinced and gave the bracha, thinking he was giving it to Esav, in other words, if you don't want to read it the Netziv's way, still, you have to admit the following. Afterwards, he gives the bracha to Yaakov, Yaakov goes out, Esav comes in, and let's assume now that that's the moment that Yitzchak realized what happened. In other words, that he was deceived. But then what does he say? It says here in Pasuk Lamed Gimel there, Esav comes in and says, you know, Yakum Avi v'yochal mitzeid b'no. Here I have it. He says, what's going on here? Who are you? Yitzchak says, and he says, Anochi, ani bincha b'chorcha Esav. Let's assume that this is the moment that Yitzchak realized what happened. He says, it says here, Vayecherad Yitzchak charada gedola ad me'od. Yitzchak suddenly became very frightened. He realized what happened. Vayomer. Mi eifo hatzad sayin ve'aveilev yochal b'kol terem tavol da'barecheyu. Wait, if you're Esav, then who was that who came in and got the bracha? And then he says, Gam Baruch Yehiyeh. He will in fact be blessed. Meaning, if you read it the Netziv's way, Yaakov never deceived Yitzchak. Yitzchak figured it out. If you read the Malbim's way, Yaakov never maybe even intended to deceive Yitzchak. But even if you read it the other way and assume that Yaakov did succeed in deceiving Yitzchak, once Yitzchak realized what happened, he then retroactively endorsed it. He could have said, wait, Yaakov gave a bracha, got the bracha, I cancel it. Or if I can't cancel it, I regret it or whatever. He endorsed it. He said, Yaakov took your bracha, gam baruch yihiyeh. So at least retroactively, Yitzchak seems to have endorsed what Yaakov did and said Yaakov was right. So to say, therefore, that Yaakov was later punished for all of this, although on the one hand, there's some significant, we saw in the earlier part of this year, that there's some significant evidence to support such a contention. On the other hand, there's some significant evidence to say that Yaakov was not wrong in what he had done to his father. If that's the case, though, then we're back to the question we started with. But then why did all these terrible things have to happen to Yaakov? And one can only say that for some reason it was divine destiny. It wasn't a punishment, it just needed to happen. But then all of those uncanny parallels, the Mirman, the Tzi'irah, and the fact that, and by the way, others point out things that we didn't have time to go into, and we don't have time to go into, but I'll just mention the parallels between the things that Yaakov later suffered and the things that he had done don't just end with what happened there. Later on, he continues to suffer from deception. Shimon and Levi deceive the entire city of Shechem and destroy it, something that Yaakov thought was a terrible thing because they could have turned to their father and said, oh, it's wrong to deceive people? Where do you think we learned that from, Dad? Mm-hmm. Right? And even more powerfully, ultimately.
With Yosef.
He deceived his father by taking advantage of his father's blindness. And they take advantage of a certain, not exactly physical blindness, but they say, you know what this, have you seen this coat before? Right? And they use that, right, through visual imagery, deceive Yaakov. So if we're going to say Yaakov was not punished, then all those parallels are just random. And therefore, in the final 2 minutes, I'd like to suggest a third approach, which is actually to simply say that perhaps both of what we just said was correct. Perhaps, yes, indeed, Yaakov was not wrong. What he did was correct, and that's what he was supposed to do. But that doesn't mean that it didn't have consequence. Not a punishment, perhaps, but a consequence. And that doesn't mean that just because Yaakov had no choice, perhaps what he did was correct, and there are times in life when you do have to become, when you do have to engage in deception. And sometimes it is necessary. But even so, that doesn't mean that there are no consequences to those actions. And Yaakov, perhaps through no fault of his own, was forced to put himself into a situation where later on he could be accused. Right? When he came later and said, but what you did to me is illegitimate, Lavan had what appears to be a very powerful response. And Leah had what appears to be a very powerful response. It's not fair. Yaakov could say, but no, but this is not the same thing. But I was right to do that. But it's true. But it puts Yaakov in a situation where it's very hard to defend. And he has to just live with the fact that he knows he's right, even though it looks like he's wrong and he has to pay the consequences. Ma'ase avot, siman lebanim. Because this is exactly the situation that Am Yisrael, the descendants of Yaakov, Bnei Yisrael, have found ourselves in again and again and again. How often do we find this today? I have students on college campuses who try to defend Israel against these absurd, what do they call it, the apartheid weeks and BDS and all this type of stuff. And yet they find themselves in situations where, as convinced, and they talk to me about it sometimes, as convinced as they are of the justice of our cause, but there are things that our opponents or enemies can quote that make it difficult, right? In the end of the day, we had no choice, but the bottom line, right, they show pictures of these roadblocks, right? And these situations where these Palestinians, or pictures of this past summer, right? You know, dead children that were killed by an Israeli shell. And we can explain from today to tomorrow, but we had no choice, and they forced us to do this, and they deliberately want us to kill their children, and what are we supposed to do? And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You killed the child. And we know we're right, and yet we're forced to be in this type of situation. Just like Yaakov. Maseh Avot Siman HaBanim. The Navi Micha says, Titein Emet LeYaakov Chesed LeAbraham. Ultimately, Yaakov's truth, the truth of what Yaakov represents, will ultimately be revealed. But it may be our destiny that until Mashiach comes, we're not necessarily going to be able to make that always clear. And perhaps that's exactly the point. Perhaps that's exactly the point, because the truth that Yaakov ultimately represents is a truth that's much deeper than the here and now. This goes back to what we talked about with Avraham, and I think it was the first year we had this year. The messages that ultimately have to get out, and perhaps that's ultimately the destiny that Yaakov was put into, to have to defend truth in a world in which it's made to look like he's in fact representing falsehood, and to suffer the consequence of that, and to have to plunge forward and make it happen. So it could be that both things are true. Yaakov was not wrong, but he suffered as a result anyway, and the Emet LeYaakov, that's the ultimate end point, but an end point that we have yet to realize, hopefully, Bezrat Hashem, in the near future.